This is Amy Long, Oral History Project for Sacramento State Fish and Game. I'm interviewing Marvin Hee on May 1st, 2012 in Browns Valley.
Marvin.
M-R-V-I-N.
What did I say?
Marvin.
Mervin. Correction. And I knew that. Okay. So this has pretty good sound, so we're doing okay. So, first of all, what is your background? Did you, as a child, did you want to be a game warden? How did you fall into this? And
yeah, I grew up in the north coast of California in a town named Mendocino. And my father was an outdoorsman, and I learned to hunt and fish at a relatively young age. As a matter of fact, I got a hunter education about age 10, started hunting it. Big game at 12, and my whole family hunted. And one day when I was about 12 years old, we were out in the middle of nowhere, and my dad was always preaching, hey, if you got to find a job, find something you really like to do. So I said, hey man, I want to be a game warden then, you know. And so that was my lifelong goal, and I basically geared my life towards getting a job as a game warden.
So how did that start? Did you go to college? Did you?
Yeah. After I graduated, my senior year of high school, I took a police science class, and the local game warden, his name was Jerry Perkins, actually came in and taught the class. It was a 1-hour class. So, you know, I got a kind of a friendship with him, and he basically told me what to do and all that. And at the time, every time they gave the test, there was about 7,000 people took the test, and they hired very few. You know, it was pretty hard to get into. So he's telling me, you got to look at other ways of getting in. And then most people went the law enforcement route and basically got in that way, got experience. And my dad was kind of not very supportive of it because, number one, he grew up, he was born in 1898. And so he kind of grew up in the era where there was no game laws. And so it was, you know, he, you know, didn't really like game wars that much. And of course, because he had some weird habits. and plus, it was hard to get into the business. You know, I guess there was very limited jobs. So I, through talking with people, decided, well, you know what I'll do is I'll get my, it was required to have an associate arts degree in law enforcement. So I'll get my associate arts degree, and then I'll do is I'll work on my degree to get in a 4-year degree so I could get into state parks, and I'll get my experience through state parks, and then I'll jump the fishing game. So made it through college in 4 years, and actually it probably would have took longer. I had an opportunity to play football in college, but I said, man, I was such a bad student, I didn't think I could be able to survive playing football. An education and getting to what I wanted to do, and I got good grades in school, and my SATs were okay, but I won a California State Scholarship, and because of my financial situation, and I qualified through the California State Scholarship, I got a grant, basically paid my, I got a free ride through college anyway, so I didn't have to play football. So I went to College of the Redwoods, got my associate arts degree in law enforcement, then I transferred to University of the Pacific. And went to UOP and got a recreation education degree. And on my senior year, I took all the state exams, and I got in the first rank state park exam. And I can't remember where I was in the warden's exam, but they weren't hiring anybody. So I went into state parks, did my 1-year ranger trainee. It's a formal training. You got to go for a year. It's kind of like field training in the academy and all the different classes you got to take, park ranger, and do your in the field training. And I did that in the Bay Area, and then I got transferred after I completed that 1-year training cycle as a state park ranger 1 in the Salt Sea State Recreation Area, where immediately I hooked up with the local game warden Alan Matthews, and I basically became the boat ranger there in the Salton Sea. I don't know if you're familiar with it. At the time, it was one of the best fisheries in the United States. And the sea's 40 miles long and 20 miles wide. And so the game warden and I, we used to go out and just write a bunch of tickets. And I actually wrote more fish and game violations on the sea than he did. So then his lieutenant came and talked to me. He says, hey, I heard you were interested in being a game warden. Yeah, and all that. Yeah, I'm on the list and all that. And he said, well, we're not going to hire anybody as a warden entry level. You got to come in as a conservation aide. And I said, well, okay, I'll do that. And so took about a year to get everything all set. And then they started offering me jobs. And I accepted the conservation aide position in Stockton. And so I got in there, let's see, 79, I think, is when I came to work at Cal Fishing Game. And I was a conservation aide for like 7 months. And then I got elevated to be a warden. And I was basically the Tracy District Warden. Worked as the Tracy District Warden for about 9 years. And basically I worked the San Joaquin Valley, the Delta, and then I had the Tracy foothills. And then because I was kind of young and energetic, and most people at the time, because they didn't hire, you know, people normally came into California Fishing Game at the time with prior law enforcement experience, usually came in around age 30. You know, I came in at age 23, I think I was at the time. I started with state parks when I was 20. So yeah, about 23, I came into Fishing Game, and so I got get shipped all kinds of different neat assignments, and basically they worked in the foothill Sierras with all the Sierra wardens during the deer season, during duck season. I was back in the valley. I got to go to the coast for abalone assignments. I got to go up to the Klamath River. I had a very, very colorful, different opportunities while I was young. And then from Tracy, I transferred to my hometown, the North Coast of Mendocino, Fort Bragg. And so I was a district warden up there, a Marine warden for 2 years. And then I finally took the lieutenant's exam, which I didn't take before because I was having so much fun as a warden, but then I got a bad lieutenant. I had a good lieutenant at the time, and I didn't think it was anything, you know, why, you know, and then I got a bad lieutenant, and I learned the lesson. It's better to be one than to have one. And so I took the exam, and I scored in the first rank. I was in Fort Bragg at the time, though, and I loved it there, and my lieutenant was great. I didn't want to promote, but then I was in a situation, family situation, where my first wife said if I don't leave the coast, I'd be divorced. And so I took the promotion and went to Sacramento. And from Sacramento, I was the lieutenant at the in the Sacramento area. I had Sacramento and part of Sutter County, and I was there, I don't know, 2 years as a lieutenant there. And then I took a lieutenant's position on a new program called the Delta Bay Enhanced Enforcement Project, which I actually created and named, got special funding, and we ran around the Delta and in the San Francisco Bay Area, basically going across region boundaries. It was the first time anybody, any unit in California Fishing Game worked multi-regions. We were working specific projects and involving anadromous fishes. And from that lieutenant's position, then I got promoted to captain. Went to be a captain in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then from there, after 2 years, I transferred to be the captain in Sacramento, which had Sacramento Valley and Central Sierra Nevada area. In 2 years there, I became acting regional patrol chief in Region 2 for about almost a year. And then I became the official regional patrol chief or assistant chief, Southern California, South Coast region. And then after that, 6 years, I retired.
So what was the time span you started? I know you said you started when you...
I started with State Parks, I think, in 77. And then I went, it was Fishing Game in 79. Mm-hmm. And then I retired in 2004, 2005, I can't remember. So I had 28 years, basically.
That's a good run. Yeah. So given the fact that you started in the 70s and clearly went through several decades, how can you tell me how your job changed from early to, did you see any changes in the duties and in what was going on and structure?
I think one of the biggest changes that we had was the demands from the public, where wardens, when I started out, you know, we were wardens, we went and we protected fish and wildlife, pollution wasn't that big of a deal, and public service calls weren't that big of a deal. And then as California, there was more pressure on wildlife, and more people and more pressure on habitat, our role kind of changed, though I think most of the older generation was resistant to that, that we changed to more to pollution response and respond to public complaints and problems with wildlife and human interaction, and then problems and the civilization encroaching on the habitat. Without the habitat, we couldn't have animals and, you know, that whole thing. And so I think the job kind of changed from traditional sense that, you know, guys would go out and they would work, you know, they go out and you know, play around in the marsh, you know, and they'd be out there working and never have to answer the radio or, you know, never had to worry about cell phone calls instead of, you know, checking the messages to see what, you know, things you had to do first before you could do, you know, plan your day. Yeah, I think the whole job changed radically.
And how did you feel about that? Was there ever a point where you thought, it's not like the old days, or did you, were you okay with the job?
That's hard to explain. I was, because I guess I was successful because I met the change. I recognized the change. I knew the change needed. I mean, and I was in the driver's seat, you know, and sort of say throughout, you know, I was in supervision management most of my career. And so I was part of that force, you know, combining the needs of the field and the needs of the public, you know, and trying to make sure that the wardens would respond and be sensitive to the public and that we would all mesh together. I guess I was on that, the leading part of that wave, you know, so
right.
Yeah, it was no big deal. I resented the idea of having to sit at an office all the time. I mean, my whole life has been, I've been very active and very much in the outdoors. And so I didn't transition real good into administrative position, and I, when I became an assistant chief, deputy, they started assistant chief and they made it deputy chief. I don't know how, I can't even remember how the sequence worked, but I sat in a room with the other ones, and there were like five of us, and I was basically the field person, where most people that got to that level were administrative people, and so it was kind of a weird mesh for me, but I was always different, a different thinker, you know. And I don't know if you've talked with the chief, our present chief, Nancy Foley. She kind of came in the same, we're kind of in the same mold, you know. We're a little bit different compared to the traditional type game wardens. Traditional type game wardens in the past were sneak and hide, you know, do our job, don't say anything, no publicity, you know, and we just want to do traditional fishing game stuff. And you know, it's one, it's your district, you're the warden in that district, you're basically the sheriff in that area, and nobody else comes in and don't do joint projects. And that all changed during my era. You know, we all, it's, the whole direction was different. Instead of one person sneaking, hiding, fighting the bad guys, it became more of directed enforcement where, you know, you saw a problem, you know, you put together a plan and people came in and, you know, you tackled it as a group when it was, when you needed to have a group.
So did you work with other agencies, or did your, within the fishing game, did you start working more as a group?
You know, when I was in the Delta, when I was the first starting out, and we worked a lot with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and then the Sheriff's Department had a fishing game unit, and we kind of worked loosely with them, but mostly U.S. Fish and Wildlife. When I went to North Coast, we worked with, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the local PD, Sheriff's Department, the Coast Guard. That was a huge group effort there. And then as we, yeah, I keep promoted through the ranks, whenever we needed help or somebody else needed help, you know, we usually exchange manpower all the time. You know, we worked a lot in different projects with different agencies.
Did that work okay generally? Was there a pretty good relationship with other agencies, or did you
at first issues? You know, when I first started, you know, no, it wasn't, but now it is. You know, the old guys were, you know, like I say, they were independent, man. They went out and they'd go out and hide in the marsh and they'd be gone for days, you know, trudging around, and they wouldn't talk to other agencies. And I'm sure that they thought they were very elite because, you know, it just wasn't a lot of interaction then. But yeah, that's changed a lot now. And plus, it's more of a dangerous world and you really need to have backup. I mean, I've been in situations where, you know, the backup's been 4 hours away, you know, it's, you know, or people couldn't even find you if you told them where they couldn't find you, or the radios wouldn't work, or, you know, we didn't have the cell phone service that we have today.
So yeah, actually, on that line, with the changes in technology, were you personally ever, you just said there were times where you had 4 hours of backup, but can you tell me an example of a story where you felt you were in the middle of nowhere and couldn't get contact, and what was going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my first year, there was an accidental discharge involving a warden and some poachers. And we actually had a flight, you know, a spotlight flight, the airplane. And we actually, it was for the very few times that the captain and the time the assistant chief was called inspectors, they were there. And anyway, a person was killed. And in order to communicate, to get help in that, we were the backup, you know, we were rolling backup to this guy. We were an hour away, you know. going in. We're rolling back up, and then we had to be the relay to get the radio so we could call on the sheriff's department and get other help in there. We didn't even actually make it into the scene. We are 2 miles away on a ridge so we could, you know, get the right information out to get everybody in there.
That's interesting. So for the person who knows nothing about your job, how would you describe your duties?
Well, it depends on what
area,
period of my career and what okay. area I was in.
How about starting with the first section when you were in your 20s?
When I was a field warden in the Delta, you know, my primary duty was basically provide all the service within my assigned patrol area. So you think I had Southern San Joaquin County. So basically my basic from the Stockton Deepwater Channel south into San Joaquin County was mine, and everything that fishing game related I was responsible for. If it was depredation where the deer were coming in or the pigs were coming in, that was one of my biggest problems, into like the golf course tearing things up, then we'd go in there and inspect it and then recommend some changes or what they could do if they could harvest animals. Then all the during the duck season, during the deer season, during the pheasant season, the dove season, then it was my job, you know, to make sure that season went off without basically destroying, you know, what was left of the wildlife. And the whole goal was to get an acceptable level of compliance from the people pursuing the sport, you know, and if there was a violation, to take action against the violation, provide assistance if there needs to be assistance, and then answer whatever public complaints involving, you know, anything related to fishing game matters and pollution response. So there was a big agriculture area and a lot of dairies, and so there was a lot of dairy pollution, and you know, because it's a kind of a wet area, this part of California, and they have, you know, dairies, they wash their animals off, so all the waste has to be disposed of somewhere, and the best thing was to do, and before I got there, was to dump it into the Delta, and that was unacceptable. And most wardens didn't like doing that, but, you know, it was one of the things that I was required to do, and I went and did it.
Yeah, it's like a lot of stuff going on. So, let's see. Have you noticed, you kind of touched on it earlier, but how could you describe how urban growth has affected either your job or areas that are now under fishing game?
Well, it's, you know, the first thing that you notice was the decline in the deer herd. When I first came here, we'd go in the winter range, and one of our jobs during the beginning of the winter was the deer would migrate in the Sierras down into the lower elevation out of the snow in the winter range. And the problem is there was a lot of poaching in the winter range. You could kill magnificent trophy animals. They could go up at night and shine their lights. And you could go up and see, you know, literally thousands of deer in certain little areas, little valleys and that, where the winter range come. And every year you see fewer and fewer deer, to where the point is, I remember about right before I transferred out of that valley district, we were up there as working with a warden named Bill Hoffman going through, and we must have saw maybe 20 or 30 deer in the winter range. I mean, it was just shocking, the difference. But if you think about it, what was happening was that people were moving into the foothills and cutting down the oak trees, which were moving the acorns, you know, and they were basically cutting the habitat, huge ranches up into 5-acre parcels, like parcels here. You know, this is a huge ranch at one time and cut up into 5-acre chunks. Well, that's what was happening, and people were changing the environment, and they were bringing dogs in there, and they were just basically changing the habits of deer. And then we have an interstate highway system. So the deer would migrate out of the Sierras, but we'd have these 65-mile-an-hour missiles going by. So the deer would go out, and boom, they'd get ran over. And so, and then the mountain lion population started taking off, which is another issue. And so then our herds were just basically, I would think that we were probably in the brink of wiping out the deer herds. But now they're coming back because of management. And we recognize the fact that we need to have that winter habitat. We need to have the areas where the deer can come and, you know, basically spend the winter or have their young so they can migrate back up the Sierras. So we were slow to react, but now we figured it out, and so now the deer herds are coming back.
So do you think California or fishing game in general, probably, I mean, fishing game versus California funding budgets, do you think that there is a better awareness of the environment, or do you think that due to budgetary constraints or...
Well, I think there's a better awareness, but I think the budgetary constraints and managing animals through the political process has really hurt California. Mm-hmm. Animals should be managed through science, This should be management, not from the vote, not this ballot initiative, you know, like the Mountain Lion initiative. I mean, that was a crime to allow that to pass. The California Fish and Game sat on their hands because we weren't allowed to comment. And so then the people of California enacted what they call an Endangered Species Act. Mountain lions were never endangered. They called the endangered species. I mean, it was just a political crap, you know. And then it opened the door to managing wildlife without science. And now they're looking in British Columbia, abandoned in British Columbia, the control of grizzly bears. Well, there's another thing. It's not based on science. It's just uneducated people making a decision through this manipulation of the political process. And now you can't control your wildlife.
So on that note, are there any other frustrations that you've seen within changes related to either budgetary constraints or?
Well, the whole thing, it was frustrating. I mean, when I left, I was happy to leave.
It was time.
It was time, yeah. You know, the whole environment has totally changed. I mean, first of all, the money situation has always been every year. In 28 years of hearing, oh, we're going to have cutbacks this, we're going to cut back that. It's so frustrating because you know you need to do your job, and they ask you to do your job but give you no resources to do your job. It's totally frustrating. It just eats on you. And when you get up higher in the political system, and I was up there in the political system, it was so frustrating. And the system is so corrupt. You know, the governor's office, and at one point in time, the governor's office under, was it Gray Davis or somewhere, when I don't know, we had this weird director. They wanted to review every formal complaint issue that was applied for by a warden before it was applied. You know, they wanted to see the paperwork. And we're thinking, wait a minute, why do you want to do that? Well, they want to protect the governor's interests. And it's totally inappropriate. You know, the things are just, it's just frustrating. Is, you know, and you get in this business, you want to save the world. I mean, we all want to do that. We want to make a positive impact. But when you see these people that working against you, it's not what's best for California and what's best for wildlife. It's what's best for whoever's in political power. And it's totally crap. And I think that's one of the things that hurts California Fish and Game, is because you need to have the support of the capital in order to get money to do your job. But if you start doing your job, you create problems for them, so they don't want to give you the money. That's how they control everything. It's crazy. It's the craziest system in the world.
So on that, following up on that, what do you see, if things continue in that direction, what do you see is going to happen in California? What's your fears?
Well, I think what's happening is what's happening right now. I mean, when I grew up, we could go out there into the ocean and we could catch rockfish. I mean, within an hour, you could have 30, 40 nice rockfish. I mean, and the limit was 15. I mean, it was no big deal. You know, people, when I grew up, didn't even really pursue rockfish, you know, because it was no big deal. But the resource is just getting depleted. You have people, the political interests that just want it their way, so then basically the resource gets raped. You know, Fish and Wildlife, they don't vote. They can't call 911. They can't complain, you know. And so, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know. And you got, you know, a limited amount of dollars, and you could, you know, give it to Fish and Wildlife, or you could give it to the people, the welfare recipients in L.A. You're going to give them to the welfare recipients in L.A., you know.
Do you know, I'm not sure how, if you know, if you're up on this information or not, but do you know, could you compare California, how it's working in California with other states?
Of course, yes, I can. I mean, I just spent the last 3 years working in Utah, working on a project for the National Park Service, you know, and Utah Fish and Wildlife, I mean, they're DNR people. I was pretty good friends with the local warden in the area I worked in, and they're a little bit more aggressive at how they do things. They basically are more wildlife oriented. They have the money to do it, and they basically work, you know, for what's best for their wildlife. I mean, they have political problems too, and they have expanding pressures in that, but they still are focused at, you know, doing their job, and the politics, I don't think, play the bigger part like in California.
Okay. So you traveled around a lot. Did you get to choose where you wanted to work, or were you pretty much assigned?
Well, when Yeah. I mean, even when I got hired, I was offered like 7 different positions, and I said, no, 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 no. And I finally accepted the one in Stockton. It was in the Central Valley. And then when it came to transfer, you know, basically there was a bid list, you know, a position became available. And, you know, my goal always was to be a warden in North Coast. And so when Fort Bragg became available, I put in for it and I got it, you know. And then when it came time for promotions, you know, you just sat there and waited until the one you came open that you wanted, and I took it.
And what were the living conditions like when you were working? Did you have housing?
There's no state housing at all. And at the time, I rented a house from a farmer in Tracy. I built a house in Tracy and never lived in it because I transferred to Fort Bragg. And I lived in the family home in Fort Bragg, and then I bought a house in Grand Bay when I came. Yeah, so I'd spend, you know, it's basically whatever resources I could get together, and I made some pretty good decisions on real estate. And so, yeah, I mean, I had a fairly standard, you know, the average American, you know, living situation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I felt sorry for some of the people when I was in Southern California. They'd come out of the academy and they were making $3,000 a month, and they were the cheapest thing you could rent, 2-bedroom apartments, $2,000, you know. I don't know how some of these guys made it. Their wives had to work, but that's part of the sacrifice for the job, you know. Mm-hmm. The reward was in heaven. That's what we used to always say.
Start the trade-off. Yeah. Did you ever work undercover, or did you ever know any other
situations? Yeah, after I went into DB, and we actually created that special enforcement unit, the people in charge say, hey, you know, that seems to be working pretty good, so maybe we're going to start doing a little bit more focused enforcement. And at the time, the department had started the Special Operations Unit, which basically was a covert undercover program. And it did pretty good when it first started out, but then it kind of slowly started dying. The money situation dried up. There were some internal problems with the unit. Basically, the guy in charge, nobody in the field liked him. And so the chiefs started doing more focal. They wanted to do special enforcement, so they had a project assigned to do abalone, and special ops did that. And they had a project they wanted to stop gill netting set line in the Delta, and then I was basically appointed to run that program. So we did a 1-year specialized deal, and we were pretty successful in gill net and set line operations. And they said, well, how come we're not doing very good in abalone? And they said, well, I don't know. And my boss at the time offered, said, hey, I'll let him come out of hit where he's working and let him do abalone and see what he can do. And so I got, at the time, I was a captain, sent over to special ops to work on abalone. And so I spent 2 years with Special Ops, and I basically resurrected Special Operations Unit and took care of the personnel problem and went into the abalone enforcement program. So I did that. And when I was first started as a warden, as a matter of fact, I got assigned to work with a Department of Justice special agent, and basically went through special agent training, went through a DOJ training, and then we went and did a bunch of things with abalone and bears. That's back in 79, did that. But yeah, I think probably my biggest expertise is undercover work now.
We talked about the abalone issue. Can you expand on that a little more, the issues with the whole, with abalone?
Well, abalone, there's only a few places in the world that have red abalone. Australia, South Africa, and North Coast of California. And so that's basically all the stocks there are. In Australia, it's been basically commercially over-harvested, and so that kind of that deteriorated. In South Africa, the companies buy the abalone beds, and it's like organized crime. I mean, it's a huge thing. In California, we were slow to react. The abalone at the time, when I got involved within the 80s, was worth $25 a piece. Now they're probably worth $150 a piece. At the time, the black market value as we were working went up to $100 a piece. So you had people who were harvesting sea urchins, which were about, you know, quarter, and mm-hmm. they'd send it over for the sushi market. But they'd be underwater in the same area. There'd be thousands and thousands of red abalones at the time. You know, we call them $25 bills. So what would you pick, quarters or $25 bills? You know, and it was a misdemeanor to commercially harvest. I mean, we had people that we busted that we thought on paper probably were making $1 million, you know, poaching abalone. And yet, it's a misdemeanor. We got a guy once with 600 abalones. Once he gets a misdemeanor, I actually convicted, put the first person that I know of, as a matter of fact, I know it's the first person the Department of Fish and Game ever put in state prison for poaching.
Good job.
Put a guy in San Quentin. As a matter of fact, I put two guys in San Quentin for poaching abalones.
Is it still a misdemeanor?
What it is that I filed the charges as a felony conspiracy. And if you look in the appellate court, it actually was appealed to the Court of Appeals and it was upheld that we could do that. They said, no, you can't take two misdemeanors and combine them and make felony conspiracy. And the court upheld you can do that. So
that's very clever. So then today, are they still misdemeanors?
No, they're felonies now. The law has been changed. And I actually went through I had two cases go. One I lost and one I won. I lost the one I charged somebody with grand theft. I caught a guy taking 200 abalones, had him in a secret compartment in his boat. And that was filed in felony grand theft that he was stealing from the state of California. And the break point that time was like $250. And the value, I figured, was about $40,000. And so we filed grand theft, saying this is a resource that belongs to the people and that he's stealing it. And we lost, which I don't think we should have lost. But the appellate court in San Francisco is very liberal. So I think if we filed it today, we might win. But
was that of your own? Did you figure that out on your own, or did you have legal?
Well, I worked with a prosecutor named, I can't remember the guy's name.
Because it's very clever, that's why I'm asking.
Well, I worked with a local prosecutor and figured it out. I made the charges, and then he carried them forward. I'm the one that basically typed up the report and said, this is what I want to charge him with.
Have you done that other instances outside of abalone, you know, where you've made an arrest or wanted to, you know, pursue legal action against someone? How does that operate?
Well, normally what happens,
is it misdemeanors and felonies, or does it vary?
Well, normally what happens is that we put the case together and we have an idea of what we're charging, right? And then we go down and we meet with the district attorney. And normally what you do is you bring it in and you sit down with the district attorney and you didn't even read the damn report. We just talk about it. This is what we want to do, you know. And normally what I did before I got into abalones, and even while I was in abalones, was that I did a lot of dairy cases. And what was really neat is that because there were only misdemeanors, and we had a guy kill about 5 miles of slough, what happened is he was dumping his so much dairy waste, and then he was getting waste from a cheese-making factory. He was getting the whey from the cheese-making process and supposedly feeding it to his cows, but he was hauling so much they couldn't eat it. So he dumped it in his wastewater pond, which flowed into the delta into a closed slough, a 5 mile slough. And basically, the anaerobic bacteria took off and basically robbed all the oxygen, killed all the fish. So, filed against him. But, you know, it's a misdemeanor. $5,000, and the most would be, you know, 6 months in jail. That's crap. And so the DA said, well, let's get him under unfair business practice. Under the business profession code, there's a law, a section in there that says that if you violate the law in order to get a competitive edge on your competitors, that's a violation, and it's a civil violation. So that stops people, say, if I don't have to get a permit, I save $100 by not getting a permit. That puts more pressure on the next business to cheat too, because they want to keep up. So what was really cool is that we basically was unlimited punishment under that business perfection thing, and the we get all investigative costs. And in this situation with the dairy, basically cost him over $1 million.
Wow.
What happened was he had to do all the cleanup, and then he had to redo his whole wastewater and made him put a commercial wastewater system into his dairy. So he couldn't even, he'd have to have, you know, aeration and filtration and all. It was the greatest thing in the world. And so we started using that. Any business that we caught violating the law, you know, we filed under business professions, which really helped special operations out, because we catch businesses buying abalone, we'd sue them to get our money back, and so that basically kept our project going. And in the past, they would actually do undercover things, and they'd try to make money, you know, say we were buying and selling illegal contraband fish. They would try to make money to pay for the operation. It says, no, we're not in business to make money. We are not in business to compete against people who are legally doing it. That's crap. We can't do that. But we'll get money this way. We'll just get the unfair business practice against these businesses, and we'll get our money back. We got cars. We got all kinds of neat things doing that.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting because, so I'm impressed with your creativity legally here, but what I'm wondering is, now, your basic laws for fish and game, things that you go out and arrest people for, is it mostly misdemeanor offenses, or are there felonies?
At the time, there was no felonies when I came into fish and game. That slowly changed. If you're commercially exploiting abalone, bear, those are felonies. And there's a couple other new felonies added. I'm not up on it now. But yeah, felonies finally got added to the punishment.
Well, that must be frustrating, though, to only have misdemeanor.
I caught some guys with 205 doves. The limit at the time was 10. I was a brand new game warden in Tracy. First year there, you know, and I'm sitting here one day, and they said, well, how do you, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to even catch guys. And, you know, I just listen for the shooting and, you know, go for it. So I heard way out, and I went, anyway, snuck up on these guys. And 205. They got a $35 fine and got their guns back. I mean, it's
frustrating.
It is the biggest bunch of crap in the world, you know? And there was no punishment, and the Department of Fish and Game spent no time cultivating the judge, nothing like that in the past. Now, you know, they have a warden's association, and it's Jerry Carnow, who's a warden up here. He's fantastic. You know, he's very well-spoken, and he talks with people, go to the legislature, he's part of the association, and they put pressure on judges, make people aware. You can't just let people do stuff like that and not give them a punishment, because you can go out at the time, it was safer to go poach abalones and go sell drugs. You'd make more money, and you wouldn't get punished. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's crazy.
Did you see a big increase in drug activity over the years?
Yeah, a lot of the people that are involved with commercial poaching are druggers, you know, and that's it. The really funny, what the name of that guy that, you know, have you been aware of that big body thing where they dug the bodies out of the well and that?
What the heck's
that guy's name? There was two guys. The speed killers?
They were calling them the speed freak killers.
Yeah, well, I was the warden in Tracy, and like I say, I worked in the Sierras during deer season. Bill Hoffman, the warden in West Point, and I kept chasing that guy around. We thought he was poaching deer. And that was our whole thing, was trying to catch this guy. And he was killing people. And that was all during the drug thing. It was all, you know, these druggies. And that's what they were doing. A lot of druggies, you know, in order to provide for their habit, they go out and poach. You know, they go get deer and sell them, and abalones and sell them. A lot of the guys, though, for abalones, that's how they supported their habits.
How often did you come across, I'm thinking of pot farms and hidden
not the pot farms is nothing like what we had now. I think I got 9-10 plantations in my career while I was in the field. Of course, I was only in the field for 9 years. I know that Dick Fredericks, the warden in Point Arena, the time that I transferred to Fort Bragg, he was just retiring. He got like 25 marijuana plantations, and he only wrote like 21 fish and game citations that year. He was an old guy, but he went and found a lot of marijuana plantations, and you'd stumble into them. And plus, you'd find people, they're out doing their dope deals out in the middle of nowhere. That's what you'd really stumble into a lot, and people stripping stolen cars and things like that. It's just incredible what you'd find, because we're the only ones out there.
I was just going to ask, if you're out there by yourself, I mean, do you ever get nervous because you're encountering either groups of people?
If you're not nervous, you're a fool.
I mean, at what point do you know when to act and when to hold back and call? And
yeah, you know, that's, I don't know. I couldn't tell you how the survival instinct works and how you make it through it. But yeah, I've been in a lot of hairy situations in my career. Yeah, a lot of things have scared me. But, you know, when you're young, you don't, you know. Today, I don't know if I could do it.
Also, over the years, can you tell me a little bit about either diversity in terms of ethnicity, gender? Did you see any changes?
You shouldn't ask me that. They're not going to like my answer.
You are free to decline any question.
Yeah. No, I think it should be a record. I came in California fishing game, was totally male and totally white. And I went through hell when I first started with this department. And as a matter of fact, I know for a fact that people in the Sierra Nevadas refuse to work with me.
Can you, just because we're recording it, can you clarify why?
Because the color of my skin. Okay. I mean, I was always called yellow fever, first day, I've been called Chinaman about 8 times, or a gook, you know, and they used to call me a hot pencil or burnt pencil or something like that, too. I mean, it was horrendous. And you know what? I became their bosses. And I've never forgotten. But yeah, it was terrible. It was horrendous.
Really? So that was from the beginning?
Yeah, from the beginning. Because they were all old guys. I was the youngest person that came to this region. I think the next youngest person in the region probably in their late 30s. You know, I came in and, you know, I'm only 22 years old.
So yeah. were you the only one, in your experience, where you were at, were you the only one that you...
I was the only off-white person in Region 2. And then a guy named Eric Wang came into Region 3. And then they finally got a black guy, came in a year after me, Raleigh Bowen, but he left right away. And then another black person was hired. And then they finally started hiring females, and that was really hard for some of the old people.
Do you know if the others that were hired on, did they have the same experiences?
I guarantee it. I will guarantee it. It was horrendous. It was ugly, you know. The females, I don't think had as much trouble as I had, because the guys were pretty, they knew what was inappropriate, but with me, they didn't care. It was no big deal. And that's probably, and I don't, when I look back at it, in my whole life, I think I've been picked on, because, you know, I grew up in an all-white community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it made me a stronger person, and I think that's why I exceeded, because I had to work twice as hard as everybody else, you know, because I was always that guy, you know. And
so were there
I think some of the females the same way. I think Nancy Foley, who's, you know, at the top now, she had the kind of the same thing, you know. And
she was interviewed. We actually listened to a portion of that interview in class, so someone already got to her. So
yeah. So
were there any policies in place? Were you able to ever report it, or did you just go with the flow?
I just went with the flow. I don't think that what. Report it, big deal. What's so, you know, I just who they were, you know. And I think you report, man, I never considered it, but geez, if you did, and you got, and you'd easily get blackballed, and holy cow, they're the only ones that are come save your butt if you're out in the middle of nowhere. My god, that would be I don't know. I just
and do you think that has changed now?
Hell yeah. So. Whole different world now. Well, the whole society's changed, you know. It's totally inappropriate. You know, and we're talking, you know, old guys that were, you know, very, very old generation, and yeah, I think things have changed radically. I mean, look, you have a female running the department, you know, and I'll take claim credit for that too, by the way. Let her hear that.
You owe me, Nancy.
I promoted her.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let's see, I had a couple here. Would you be willing to tell me some of your most unusual experiences?
As in what? I mean, every other day is unusual in this job, that job.
Maybe some standout stories. What are some stories you would tell around a campfire?
Oh, yeah, war stories, huh? Well, let's see. What's worth telling? Well, my first day in Fort Bragg, I always wanted to go there, Mendocino, Fort Bragg, you know, and I was sent on assignments there and all that, and my lieutenant at the time, before I transferred, and I'll use names, you can delete them, whatever, Buck Del Nero, and he was a shitty lieutenant. We were wardens together, and we used to go on boat patrol, and I wrote a lot of tickets in my career. I used to write 1,500 a year. I wrote 1/6 of the entire department caseload 1 year by myself. Anyway, Buck Del Nero was a warden, and he'd write 60, 70 tickets a year, and I'd be writing 150 a month. And so he wasn't real ambitious, but he liked to drive the boat, you know, and I liked to go out and write tickets. And so he'd drive the boat, and I'd write all the tickets, make all the contacts, and I'd let him sign every other one. So his violation rate went from like 60 to 250 a year. Wow, he's doing really, look at this guy. And they promoted him, being my boss. And then, what a jerk. And so he kind of gave a weird thing about me. And so I wanted to go to the North Coast. This old lieutenant, it was in Region 3 one day, I was on a special assignment up there, and I was count my abalone. I'd written about 15 or 16 tickets, and I had this one case I made there, I guess 45, 50 shorts, and I'm sitting there counting them and lining them up, take a picture, and this little guy comes up and he looks over and he says, "Well, that De Niro wasn't full of shit after all, was he?" I go, "What do you mean?" He says, "He said you were a good game warden." And the guy was just, you know, just begrudgingly, just and then I kind of snickered. But anyway, the lieutenant, that local lieutenant, came in after him and says, "Hey, you know, we're going to have an opening here. I want you to come up here." And so anyway, I finally got the job. And first day on the job, and I thought, wow, this is great. You know, my mom was there in the family home, and my family stayed in the valley until we could relocate. And my mom was basically dying from diabetes. And so I lived with her. And the first day I got up at about 6 in the morning, and I'm going to go out and enjoy it. And I have my patrol truck, and I'm in uniform. What I dreamed of when I grew up, you know, you'd be, you know, game warden in your local town. And I go up to this place, and I'm on a headland. It's a beautiful morning, you know, Chris, and I'm sitting on this peninsula off Casper Bay, and I'm, man, this is really cool. You know, I'm looking around, I feel really good, and I'm looking to the north, and I see a flash of light, like something reflecting off metal. I'm like, what the heck? And I look over there, and there's a guy in a scuba tank getting in the ocean at 6 in the morning. Holy cow, that's weird. So I run back to my truck, get my truck drive all around the bay, and I go to this pullout. You know, I grew up there, so I knew kind of everywhere. So, you know, and no car. That's weird. Where'd he park? Did he walk through the houses? You know, it was quite a walk. And so, you know, I hide my car, and I go hiking out to the headlands, and I'm out there, and I'm looking around. I see nobody around, no sign of anything, and I'm looking at the water, you know, and I can see the, you know, the scuba divers and the bubbles come up to the surface, and there's a seagull sitting there poking at these bubbles, and I thought, what the hell's that? Yeah, you know, I didn't know that. Why would this seagull be, you know, why? It was kind of weird, so I'm just looking at it, and thinking, that's strange. Anyway, I finally go down to where I think I've seen the guy, and I'm searching the rocks, and in this crevice, I find an extra air tank and a bunch of duffel bags. I thought, man, something's bad here, you know. So I get back up on top of the headlands, you know, it's about 90 feet up, and I'm watching this guy. And finally, this guy comes into the, and he's got a duffel bag like this, huge. And I can see through, it's a mesh duffel bag, and I can see the abalone feet, you know, they got a kind of a weird color. I said, oh, that guy's poaching abalones, you know. And so, oh, man, this is great. My first day, this is going to be really cool. And so I'm hiding. He's getting, he stays in his wetsuit, but he starts coming up the trail, you know. Okay, he's got to wind up this really steep trail. And I better get away from it because he'll throw the evidence over. So I get back up into the deep grass, and he starts walking up. And I'm hiding in the grass, and he gets near me, and I jump up, says, "Fishing game warden, you're under arrest." And he turned around, and he's sprinting to the cliff. And I, oh, crud, and I'm running like hell, and I finally catch him, and I reach out, and I grab him like this, and then he spins, and he's in a wetsuit, and it's kind of wet, you know, and I can't grab, and I'm trying to get a hold of him, and I finally grab a hold of the bag, and we're tumbling around and fighting, and next thing I thought, something doesn't feel right, and I kind of look down, and I'm on the edge of the cliff. I go, holy cow, and I kind of move a little bit, and he spins around, and I let go of the bag, and he goes, yeah! into the ocean, 90 feet.
What?
And I go, oh, shit. And then the guy's floating, he's in his wetsuit, so he's floating, and I go, hey, and I fly, scramble down the cliff, hey, you all right? And he tries to swim away, and I go, buddy, where are you going? You can't go anywhere, you know. He's kind of hurt, but what he's doing, he's shaking out the abalone. He's getting him out of the bag, and he finally comes in, and I get him, and I put him in handcuffs, and I said, you're going to jail. I'm hurt. Oh, I said, no, you're going to jail. So I get him up, and I take him to the local PD, and I, like I say, I just got first day, and the first thing I walk in the booking facility, here's a guy, two guys I played football with. One's the chief investigator for Fort Bragg PD, and the other guy's a sergeant. And they see me, and they just start laughing. This guy's, oh, this guy tried to, the guy's yelling, Tommy's like, you're trying to kill me, he's trying to kill me, you know, and they finally get the other paramedic. It was a CHP paramedic who I worked with when I was in high school, and he was a local boy, and came in. It was just so funny.
So whatever happened to that guy? Did he get his $35 fine?
No, he actually got off.
Oh.
He was a DEA transplant. He was a from Florida. And DEA came in. We had a big meeting and all that. And he had to pay restitution and all that stuff. And they actually had the CHP diver come. And I wasn't a state diver at the time. I had to go recover all the evidence and that. But anyway, he was basically a relocation and protected witness. And so they had to basically relocate him and pay restitution to California Fish and Game.
He was a... Can you say that again?
He was a he was relocated by DEA. He was in a drug sting in Florida, and he was state's evidence, and so he got relocated to North Coast and set up in the diving business.
Huh.
So they came in and took care of him.
That is an interesting story. okay, and where am I?
One time I worked with this one warden, I'll never forget, Ernie Neese, and I actually was back up when I was young, and you know, I was the people they didn't like, but I kind of got a good reputation because he got in a couple splats and I had to fight people. One time we were doing them, they were snagging salmon on the Woodbridge Dam, and he came, instead of walking in, he drove in, and the lieutenant was on the other side, and the guy saw him and took off running, and I'm in undercover under the bushes way down the bottom so I could look up and watch them do their thing, and he goes running by me, and I go, hey, come here, and he stops and looks at me, and he starts walking to me, and then he figured out, oh shit, this is not right, and takes off running, and he's running across a Woodbridge golf course, and I'm chasing him, and he comes off a green, and these people are putting through, and I tackled him and knocked him down and put him in handcuffs. Everybody's looking at it. And then the next time I was working with Ernie Neese, the guys were snagging salmon again, and the lieutenant was actually there again, coming on the other side, and this guy grabs this kid and says, you're under arrest. And of course I thought, oh, this ain't gonna be good. There's a crowd, and the kid pulls away like that and starts to run, and of course I drop him on the ground and flip him over, and next thing I thought, what the heck? Something passed by my head, and I look up, and his brother, who was a gangbanger at the time when the first La Familia or whatever, it was the first time Mexican gang had showed up in the valley, but anyway, they were members, and he had taken a wooden club and tried to whack my head off.
Oh my God.
And there's people, all of a sudden, the big, you know, like 20, 30 people there that kind of descended upon him, and of course, the old warden, I don't know what he was doing, and he finally turns and starts talking to the guy, and I get up because I don't want to get my head knocked off, and the kid takes off running, and the crowd's got this other guy with the club pinned, and this other kid's running away. And well, I can't let him get away, so I take off chasing him and end up running through the town of Woodbridge down the middle of the highway, and I tackled him and pinned him right in front of a bar in the middle of the road, and I reached back to grab my handcuffs, and no handcuffs. And I got this kid going, I got him in a bar lock, and I don't have no handcuffs. I can hear I'll never forget, the best sound I ever heard was the sirens of the local PD going, and everybody on the bar outside looking at me, and I've got this kid pinned on the ground. It's funny.
That's funny. Would you, knowing what you know today, having gone through all this, would you do it all over again?
Yeah, I had 28 years where I never had a job. This is my wife always gives me a hard time. You need to go to work now because you never worked a day in your life. And it's true. I never have. It was fun. It was pure fun. It wasn't like work at all until I promoted. Near the end, it got to be more of a job, you know, meeting with attorneys and crap. I never forget, we had 250 wardens when I got hired and two attorneys. And at the time when I retired, I think we had 250 game wardens and 17 attorneys.
Would you recommend this totally job to anyone today?
Hell yeah, it's a great job. I don't want my son
even
to do
today,
it,
with changes, you know, you think it's still...
It's a great job, but, you know, it's the idea of living in poverty and having to worry about cutbacks. And then, I don't know, I don't know. I think it's inappropriate to pay people with what they get paid and what they have to do. It's just not right, you know, especially now more and more drug stuff and more and more things that are not traditional wildlife, things that you got to do and for what little pay. To me, it's a great job, but man, if you want to survive and have a family, I don't think it's a really good way to go. You can't provide for your family with what little money they make.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen the show Wild Justice?
Yeah, I reluctantly watch it once in a while. My wife makes me watch it.
What your impressions of it is.
Well, you know, it's a TV show.
Right.
You got to make the drama.
Do you see that is it definitely edited for television?
Yes.
Do you think it's realistic at all?
Yeah, some of it is. Some of it is, some of them isn't. Yeah, I mean, I look at some of their operations there that they got, you know, hundreds of people. That's, yeah, it doesn't work that way, but it's TV.
Right. And let's What do you, well, actually, since there's shows like that on TV now, well, there's one, anyway, maybe you can answer this. When you were working, what was the public's perception of game wardens, and do you think that's changed?
I think that's way changed quite a bit, and like I say, in the beginning, we didn't really let anybody know what we did. We just kept our heads down and did our job, and that changed, slowly started changing. We never had a public information officer. Matter of fact, the public information officer for Region 2 was me until I promoted Mark Lucero, who basically had a TV background before he came to Fishing Game, and Mark Lucero became kind of like the PIO for Region 2, and then they finally hired Patrick Foy, you know, but never, he finally, law enforcement took him on because, you know, he kind of just bounced around. And with DB, it became a political thing where, you know, we had to, you know, basically provide an image of what we were doing to justify getting all the money. I mean, we were getting like $5 million a year to do this project. And so we started to do a little bit more publicity. And when we started making big busts, we'd have press releases and finally got some people at headquarters. When they combined law enforcement and public information together, or the public education branch, and then we started getting people, you know, to get the message out, and they realized that, you know, we were always on the cutting block, you know, our heads were always on that chopping block, and that, hey, maybe we better let people know what the hell we do, you know, because we're really in a lot of places, and it's the truth is that we're the only law enforcement people see. Mm-hmm. And think about this, you know, we enforce all state laws, all federal government laws, 200 miles out to sea. And once you get 3 miles, nobody has any law enforcement jurisdiction until the Coast Guard and us, because we're federal deputies. And we can go to any state in the nation, and we do all county and city ordinances. So we're the most powerful law enforcement people in the state of California.
Did Fish and Game ever have a relationship with outside environmental groups? And was that ever a good thing, or was there ever issues with people kind of trying to, you know, like independent groups? Maybe Sierra Club, I'm just using it as an example, or any group. Was there ever conflicts, or was it a cohesive relationship, or was there any relationship at all?
We had a few relationships, and I think the Ferret Society was kind of a weird marriage, you know, because, you know, there was a society that loved ferrets, and ferrets were illegal in California, but it ended up being a good working relationship because, you know, we were wasting a lot of time going picking ferrets up and getting rid of them, 10 miles of state. And then we could call the ferret people up and they would come and take care of it. We wouldn't even have to pay attention to it. So we learned to work with those organizations and learned to get along, like Save the Bear or the Bear League in Lake Tahoe. That was a rough start getting that relationship going. And once they got it going, it works great. So it's kind of like, and a buddy of mine who works for Fishing Game at retired, he was mad because PETA provided the dog food for the dog program. You know, that's to me, you know, he was thinking that's unacceptable and all that. And I'm thinking, no, that's good. You know, you got to work within all the organizations because, like I say, it's such a fragile situation with the budget. You can't afford to make enemies.
Were there any groups that ever gave you guys problems?
Oh, of course, all kinds of, every one of them did.
So it was a give and take.
Yeah, that comes with the territory, yeah.
Okay, and I think I had just a couple more. I lost my thing. And what do you... So just kind of wrapping it up, unless you had anything else you wanted to add about your experience to Fish and Game or anything I didn't ask or didn't cover that you feel is important to document?
Yeah, I don't know. There's tons of war stories, and it was a good career. It's like 28 years of playing. I mean, I'm energetic now because I don't feel like I really worked. It's hard on your body, though, and I think if you talk to anybody Fishing Game, you know, you only could take a certain amount of pounding from the four-wheel drive trucks and carrying all the weight and stuff that we got to do and things. It's hard on you, and at the end, you know, you hope to retire and go out and enjoy it, and I got to retire fairly young because I started young, but it's, you know, I pay the price every day. I mean, I feel my body, my back's held together with pins and plates and all that, and I feel it every day, and it's just, You know, it's, if anything I could change, I wish I could change that.
Yeah. All right, then. I believe I've asked all my questions. And I want to say thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it.